Welcome again to Back to the Fucture, the podcast that plugs you into tomorrow's thinking today by talking to the people who are doing tomorrow's thinking today. This podcast, I'm joined by the doing, thinking and project management brains behind PCH Innovations, Adrian Hope and Deb Mishra. You're both very welcome.
Thanks, Martin. It's a pleasure to be back. I think almost exactly 2 years after our first time on your podcast series. A lot has happened since then for all of us, and I'm very excited to return.
Well, in fact, it is just coming up to 2 years, which is why I thought it would be a good time to have you back. And also, you know, for a moment, just remind listeners what you do to kick off the podcast.
Yeah, PCH Innovations is basically a creative engineering studio for exploratory technology, from robotics to software. So executive teams come to us to tackle the challenges that I believe most corporations are facing today. I can see two main ones. The first one is about manifesting with tangible solutions their ambitions when it comes to sustainability or circularity. Many companies have noble goals, but they don't actually know exactly where to start or what are the next steps. So we help them on a strategic but also technological level to find these steps, not just to think. That means we build prototypes, MVPs, around new methods of make and new flow of matter. So our work gravitates a lot around sustainable fabrication, digitally enable circularity and transparency, or AI enable workflows.
So quite exploratory. And in fact, when we chatted, it was, what I call BC, as in before COVID. And I guess a lot of the things we talked about were, it was about exploration, it was about new materials, about testing new ways of solving problems or challenges. And I guess since then, one of the big challenges has been COVID. And then we had quite a few others with, you know, the war in Ukraine, business failing, inflation. And I really just wanted to ask you now, perhaps Dev, you can answer this. Has all of the things that has happened since 2020 changed the way clients, for example, or business leaders think about innovation in terms of the problems we now need to solve in the world?
Yeah, definitely. Firstly, I would like to say thanks for having us again. And I mean, I'm an avid follower of the podcast, so I'm very happy to be part of it in time, back from London, actually, where we were showcasing one of our projects for Nike.
You were indeed. In fact, I did pass it. I was traveling through the West End one dark and dreary evening in this fantastical, beautiful, technological, it could be a robot, it could have been an installation, it could have been a concept for the future, cropped up on, I think it was Nighttown, on the screens outside, showing me a way to have my trainers tested, cleaned, revitalized, and also in the process of doing it, have a bit of the planet saved as well. So I'm guessing that's probably what you were up to.
Yes, exactly. It's called Bot Initiated Longevity Lab, which is the full form of Bill, named after Nike co-founder Bill Bowerman. Yeah, and to get back to your question, I mean, over COVID, of course, there has been a difference in views across industries. And as a more conservative step, I think we can all agree that we saw immediate budget cuts across industries. But the more visionary leaders actually chose to buckle down upon the challenges at hand, as well as the new challenges that emerged via COVID, and to invest time and resources into a more targeted approach to innovation. And that is actually pretty much where we come in. And I mean, we like to use technology as a medium to encourage and inspire change in the right direction by building proof of concept, which on one hand can excite, but on the other hand, actually increase the efficiency of today's processes. And quick shout out here to our partners at Nike, Noah Murphy and his team, for their faith and trust in us during this period and enabling us to create some of the work you see out there.
I mean, it's interesting because despite, I think, the challenges of COVID, and despite, I think, the uncertainty that a lot of people felt going through it, one of the key outcomes, this is something that we identified recently in our polarity paradox trend briefing, that the thing that we were surprised with is that Gen Z, so those people under 25 and Gen A, those people coming into that age group from 16 up, were more positive than ever about science and innovation and technology and its ability to save the planet. But in contrast, when we looked at people in their 50s, 60s and above that, they were more uncertain than ever about science's abilities to save and innovate and help us get this coming crisis. And I just really want you to meditate for a moment on why you think, apart from the obvious age issue, why do you think that we have such divisionary and segregated views about the power of science and innovation to tackle these big problems that we need to look at the moment?
I mean, in a way, like, this is not a new dynamic, right? As you said, the age difference, we've felt it before. The young tend to romanticize the future, the old romanticize the past. And this tension has been something that we need to challenge. And in our work also, we kind of try to move away from an absolute narrative. Our hardware that we build, the robot Bill, combines traditional handcraft with advanced robotics and AI, because both are enriched by one another. And to kind of reconcile these two forces or this polarity that you're talking about, what is needed is a certain amount of humility. Younger consumers should be able to respect and reflect what has built the foundation that they are able to see their future on. And older consumers kind of have to appreciate that what they're nostalgic for was probably unwelcome at some point in history, and that it has emerged from something necessary, at least partly.
I think, as somebody identified it in the briefing we delivered, as the false comfort of nostalgia, that it gives us a certain sense of, you know, anchorage, a certain sense of not just comfort, but of stability and security at a time, as I think a lot of people are arguing, and certainly that younger group you're talking about, at a time when we really do need to move forward, and we need to move forward at speed, and I guess in a way that isn't just about solving a problem, but not creating other ones. And that was one of the things, that maybe Adrian, if you can kind of think about that. How do you, when you're looking at innovating and bringing new concepts to market, ensure that you're not also bringing a problem or another way to deplete the planetary resources when you're solving an issue that you may be asked to do so by a CEO or a brand?
Well, I think to follow up on what they've said, and I think that's a direct consequence of COVID, this idea of humility really diffusing in corporation and especially in management. I think what we have seen is that this polarity has been reduced on some of the key challenges. And I think there is a unified, or let's say a more homogeneous view on these most important challenges. One of them, for example, that we are strongly working on is, you know, COVID has shown how precarious our global supply chain were. And this has pushed this concept of reshoring. And I think across companies, the idea of increasing sovereignty on your supply chain, on how your goods are made and on your means of production has become more and more at the forefront. That's great for innovation because it's a super challenging topic, of course, but it's also great for one of our core drivers, sustainability, as we need to innovate in terms of, you know, material loops and shift from supply chain to supply network. And it's quite funny, actually, because a colleague of ours was saying earlier, like, for our parents, innovation was all about getting rid of the means of production and externalizing. And our generation is really the opposite. So I think we have seen an increased openness to the most radical changes when it comes to rethinking market, products and production. And there's an overall rising awareness of our interconnectedness. In some of our past work, as you know, we have approached this topic through the angle of philosophy and spirituality, but now we are trying to apply it and develop solutions from an industrial perspective.
I am fascinated that you say that, because I remember when we spoke before COVID, we were talking about the Changing Matter catalog.
Exactly, yeah.
Which I think you were about to launch. And one of the things I'd queried at the time was how, as innovators and as scientists and engineers and technologists, you were happy to bond that kind of thinking to areas of spirituality, areas of astrology, I think in some cases, are also areas of kind of abstraction, which bordered, as I thought about it at the time, into what would be classed as quack science. Jump cut to now, when I think about the debates going on about quantum, for example, and the debates going on about the spirituality of technology and innovation, and also how we need to bond philosophy and ethics into this whole area, I'm going, wow, you were slightly ahead of the thinking and I was a bit behind, which is unusual for me. So I just wanted you to kind of go back again and take the Changing Matter catalogue, think about the things you mentioned then. How have they changed, or also how have they become more relevant in the way we need to talk with the consumer in the marketplace?
I mean, for those who do not know what the Changing Matter catalog is, it's a catalog that we released 2 years ago, and it's a catalog of ideas and approach for whole system transformation. So it's an homage to the Whole Earth catalog, which was published more than 50 years ago by Stuart Brown. And it was a counterculture catalog focusing on self-sufficiency, ecology, alternative education, DIY movement, and holism. And the funny thing is that it was all about, back then, about thinking and living beyond the idea of productivism and a search for inspiration and meaning and alignment with nature. And today, we are post-productivism. You know, back then, it was full productivist era. Back then, climate change was an opinion. And today, it's the complete opposite. You know, these are facts, and we are post-productivism era. If you look at the most valuable companies in the world, they don't really produce in a classical sense anymore. So what is really valuable nowadays is creativity over productivity. Brand equity, human capital, these are the critical assets. And so what we're trying to push in this catalog, but also in our work, is about developing competencies around vision, adaptation, inspiration. In the catalog, we were trying to bridge, let's say, the gap between this very spiritual and esoteric approach that Stuart Brand initially crafted into, let's say, the challenges of today and to a certain degree what corporations are facing. So we are thinking of developing, you know, for example, new metrics of value like return on ideas, return on kindness, return to nature. And these are the things we are trying to craft in our work.
So if we'd had this conversation with CEOs, I'm putting, you know, a bet on 2 years ago, they would be challenging you and dismissing it as not a great way to measure profit or even to produce increased value in a business. And now, of course, these are exactly the terms that I hear when I speak to CEOs about how do we make people happier? How do we improve well-being? How do we improve our sense of value in terms of values, not in terms of profit? So I really felt that you had hit on quite profound insights at the time when perhaps people were being dismissive of it. And in fact, I just wanted to kind of add to that. We launched our Futures 100 Innovators Award earlier this month. And one of the most interesting aspects of looking at these top 100 innovators who were pretty much in their 30s and 40s and coming to the market for the first time was their focus on diversity, on inclusion, on regenerative approaches, on purpose, on ethics. In fact, all of the things that you had listed in the catalogue and perhaps people had dismissed as marginal at the time. So I just wanted you to maybe consider, if that's where we are now, what are the things that we should be embracing for tomorrow to really get these changes embedded and to really get this new thinking that you were hinting at in that catalogue just as a standard part of business talk and business action and business solution?
Yeah, I mean, that might sound a bit counterintuitive because at the end of the day, we develop AI system, robots. But what we believe in is actually in blending the worlds between the technical and the natural. And we are trying to, you know, reimagine factories as forests or sneakers as compost, waste as feedstock. Because at the end of the day, nature is the foundational inspiration and is one of the most efficient and effective systems. So I think now leading corporations and, let's say, visionary leaders, they also want to align the relationships between industry, environment, and community. And what takes a lot of our work right now, for example, with our partners, is this idea of redesigning loops of material in sync with local communities, with regional resources. And this has an untapped potential for corporations to develop new products and services that are really more in sync with the aspiration of everyone, I believe. And even like big tech are also looking into it and are giving us more and more the tools to do that. So I think this is where we are going, and we're going to go into that in an even more accelerated way.
Well, okay, maybe Dev, on the next question, which is really more about while you're answering a brief and producing a solution, you know, for a brand or a business or a CEO, how much of it is also about educating them to think differently and to understand the wider concepts that perhaps you're tackling when you decide to create something like Bill, which ostensibly is just repairing, cleaning, extending the life of the shoe. So how much of it really is about also extending the education and the insight of the brand or the CEO that you're dealing with?
I think it's a lot about that. And I mean, a lot of times when clients come to us, it's often we end up going on a journey with the client. And often through this journey, we discover that maybe the destination that we had set out in the beginning might not be the most interesting one. So we pivot, we change, and we spin off new ideas. And in a way, we are very privileged to have clients who are going on these journeys with us. But I think that's also like the fundamental belief that clients come to us, that even if we don't achieve what they set out for, we are going to create something meaningful and fruitful together. And in terms of educating the client, I think we are at the stage where it's like the education aspect has kind of been covered. Like it's established that we need to move away from patterns of the past, the harmful behaviors. And at this stage, it's mostly about how fast can we get there. It's about accelerating these processes, which is what like the winners of the Future 100 innovators are doing. They're accelerating the shift away from bad behaviors, or making sure that we pick up the good habits and that will be in the benefit of the planet in the future.
I mean, I guess what surprised me as well was how few of them were about technology in the traditional sense. You know, they had obviously focused on the subject, like sustainability, for example, or purpose or optimization. And then by doing that, they were able to bring in, it could have been a platform, it could have been like, I think the woman who won it, Catherine Nakanabe, had actually used satellite data, machine learning, and algorithms to help improve predictability in weather systems across Africa. So, you know, to improve crop rotation, she took a step back and looked at weather systems rather than looking at, you know, fertilizer and the things that we normally look at. And that also reminded me that a lot of time innovation comes through, as she said, not about the obvious thing, but either looking at the unobvious solution or even taking two steps back and realizing that there's a bigger challenge afoot that perhaps this tiny little question that a CEO's asked us is really required in the answer. So do you find that sometimes when you're solving one problem that actually you've cracked a bigger question or challenge that perhaps is of concern to more people?
Yeah, I mean, if we take the example of the project Dave was delivering until very recently, the bigger question is around extending the life of our everyday goods. And you can approach it through very different ways. We tend to approach these things in unusual perspectives. At first, you know, we know our USPs and we know we have an expertise in robotics and automation. So we started to craft ideas on how could robotics and automation help in the extension, let's say, of sneakers. And as we are moving forward in this journey with our partner, we really unfolded many, many different types of solutions that connect together. The use of robotics in retail is, for example, quite new. And for us, it's really about activating these sustainability services. It's about augmenting the creative capabilities of the consumers, but also the capabilities of what, in that case, Nike can do on sneakers. And as we are moving forward in this journey, we are developing solutions down the road that go much beyond, let's say, a sneaker repair robot. At the end of the day, it's about transforming the purpose of retail as the interface between brands, products, and communities to create what I was talking earlier, these new loops of matter. So we started with the topic of repair, and we actually end up thinking of completely new value and material loops, for example.
Just to add to that, part of it is like, okay, robotics and automation in the retail space. But when we started talking about repair, what became very obvious was also that there has to be a lot of material innovation, which has to be the material that we use for repair. And this is not something that we had gone into thinking. So we worked a lot with Nike design teams, for example, to come up with a simple material which robots can work with in a way. So the material was also specifically engineered for this application. And I think these are the things that you're kind of talking about, that we go in thinking of one challenge, but there is another challenge that we end up solving in the process.
Absolutely.
Right. So, I mean, really, I guess what you're saying there is that innovation in its wider sense is about the journey and the learnings in that journey rather than just the straightforward solution. Because I think a lot of people, particularly, you know, businesses I will deal with, when they think about innovation, they instantly want or see it in the context of solution. And I guess what you're telling us here is that we should also see it in the context of the additional learnings and actually the long-term solutions it brings by simply tackling what seems to be a fairly straightforward, brief response from one of our clients. You know, they want us to do A, we do it, and that's the end of it. And I think perhaps that's how a lot of clients see it. And in fact, what they should be seeing, I guess, is that there is more embedded in this that can be taken out and used over a period of time. I mean, this is one of the things I was curious to chat to you about, because, you know, COVID, for example, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, you know, has impacted our lives in many ways. And I guess we kind of discussed how it affected innovation. But I wanted to kind of get a sense of how you think it has changed the way you relate to innovation, for example, in retail, which has changed because of COVID, the way we relate to automotive, which in some ways has changed because of how COVID changed our cities, and also the workplace, you know, how the workplace has hopefully been irrevocably changed by this impact of COVID. But it must surely have also an impact on how you see innovation, because I know these are all spaces that you work in terms of the questions you're answering for clients.
Yeah, I think for most people, COVID has slowed down their daily life. It has given us more time to think, more time to reflect. And I think this is something we have seen in how corporations and consumers are thinking about, for example, sustainability. It has made the notion of circularity more visible and more tangible. But also, obviously, COVID has pushed us online in the digital space. You know, every day we hear about metaverses and so on. But I think the more as a society we move into the digital, the more we realize that we need physicality. We need social connection. And that's why the retail spaces will be reinvented. As I said, they will become increasingly relevant touch points. And I think beyond the retail spaces as we know them, we will see the emergence of new types of collaborative places, networked environments. Maybe Dave, you can share something about that we are doing in Berlin, actually.
Yeah, I would add a couple of things. I think across all industries and spaces that we work in, what we've noticed is also that over this COVID period, there is networks and collaborations forming, kind of to partly shield organizations being singularly affected by a COVID-like phenomenon and to build that resilience that everyone is talking about these days, but also to be able to innovate over a bigger playground. For example, like we were working with one of the largest automotive suppliers last year at the peak of COVID, and we were stressing upon the need to form consortiums across the value chain. And as we were pitching this idea, there were consortiums being formed in the fashion industry, in the automotive industry. And so there was living proof of what we were suggesting in a way. And to add to what Adrian said, the importance of physical space, like as we as PCH are also constantly trying to reinvent, because we work a lot with digital technologies, robotics and AI, but at the peak of COVID, we took a decision to invest in a physical space, which is an abandoned industrial building outside Berlin called Mahalla, and which is to serve as a new physical playground for our crew. There's a lot of exciting things that we're planning there at the intersection of technology, music, and art. And this could, in a sense, be a new chapter to our work, for example.
Fascinating, because the previous guest on the podcast was a man called Ibrahim Ibrahim, who's just written a book on future-ready retail. And one of the things, because he designs like pretty much creates these fantastic retail interiors, you know, for retail malls, department stores, streets, etc., is he was saying that we have to stop seeing it in the traditions of the current retail definition or way of doing things. He said, if you think about it in terms of, you know, theatre, entertainment, hospitality, performance, and then you apply the notion that you're not dealing with the customer or a client, you're dealing with an audience. He said it really changes what he says from points of sale to points of connection. And that's really, I think, what you're talking about is how by doing and shifting and using these technologies in a different way, we're trying to connect with people rather than simply trying to sell them things. Because that is a greater experience and a greater moment. And I think probably brings greater value to the moments when the customer or the audience, as we're now going to call them, comes to you. One of the things that has always fascinated me about your work in that context is the fact that you are talking about robotics and you're talking about AI and you're talking about things that sound perhaps to the uninitiated listener or somebody who doesn't know your work, it sounds quite cold. But when you think about what you do, it's quite engaging and it's quite magical and it's quite entertaining and it makes me want to talk about. So when I caught that Nike Town window as I was flashing past in my cab, it really caused me to pause and hesitate and to want to go back and have a look. And that's what reminded me to call you. And I think, my gosh, if that's what retail does in that sense, it's hugely different to how retail works now. So I just want you to perhaps give us a little, because I know a lot of listeners work in the retail sector, a little more about how you think the kind of things you do can enhance this magic and experience that retail really needs to get it back up and running. Not in the same way, but in a different and perhaps more compelling and relevant way to the current future audience.
I mean, that's actually for us the most interesting piece of work. It's really about changing how people look at these kind of technologies. As I said, we don't see an opposition between these technologies and, let's say, the more humane type of activities. I think, as I said, in connecting to changing matter in the 60s and 70s, that's where actually robots and automation came in. And that's why we still associate very much these technologies to this era, to this thinking of utilitarianism, of productivism. But our work is all about changing the perspective on those and really create solutions that fulfill the, let's say, the universal needs and aspirations, whether it's for workers in warehouses and companies or, let's say, for consumers in the future places and future retail spaces. It's really about changing the application of these technologies. And I think, as you said, what's a bit magic with, let's say, the consumer-facing type of robots we are working on, we use them as a hack for propelling this idea of reculture. We believe that there's a certain sense of magic into how humans and technology can be paired together to do unprecedented things, things that are not possible only with technology or not possible only with humans. So for us, it's all about creating this kind of new harmony, this human-machine harmony in service of the big challenges we were talking about earlier. And retail is one thing, but also, you know, if you go very early in the development of ideas or products, what we are very interested about is looking at, let's say, paradigm shift in technology, like in AI with these large models. Our belief and what we are strongly working on right now is leveraging the power of these large models with the progress, let's say, in computer graphics to completely transform how you design ideas, products. And we believe we are at the verge of really a revolution in democratization of design. You know, we have all heard of what's possible nowadays with things like Stable Diffusion, with a movement like open source. And I think that new kind of harmony between human and technology is really essential to work on. But that requires guidance, that requires experimentation and exploration. And I think that's one of the key reasons why clients come to us, because we spent a lot of time, dedication and passion with our team working on these things.
I mean, I've obviously been fascinated by, you know, when I even look at the people you work with, you know, the engineer, technologist, programmer, philosophers, you know, filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that struck me is that all of those people, all of those categories, have usually learned their art or their understanding of the world, not just through success, but through the notion of chance encounters and sometimes failures. And I wanted you just because I'm aware, again, some listeners will come from an innovation background. I've had a couple of questions already, people saying, ask the chaps about serendipity and the role this plays in brokering solutions or creating innovations that really change the game in terms of what is possible currently in the world. I mean, what's your thoughts on serendipity? I don't know. Adrian, did you want to answer that one?
Serendipity, to be honest with you, when I joined PCH almost 10 years ago, I never heard of that term. And I think it's one of the first terms that came to me when I discovered the studio and the work of our founders. And I was really intrigued by it because it's something that is foundational to our DNA. And it's also foundational to a certain degree to my personal story and the personal stories of everyone in our studio. And I think especially right now in innovation, it can be that we are overwhelmed by methodologies and processes and repetition. And I think at the end, it puts a danger on innovation. And that's why in our studio, when we try to implement too much processes of, or methodologies, we see actually we are slowing down. We stop changing, we stop learning. So being open to serendipity, being open to the idea of like, yeah, fostering environment, places and discussion that trigger serendipity, for us, it's essential.
I mean, I think there is just, to put it in context, there is a science behind it. In fact, one of the people I interviewed recently is Christian Busch, who is a person who teaches, and I found this fascinating, teaches serendipity as a business framework at New York University. So he's actually openly teaching entrepreneurs and innovators and people who want to succeed and broker change how to be open and how to embrace chance, but also how to look for it. Because he said, you know, it's not a question of where some people are lucky and some people are unlucky. He said, those who are lucky because they make their own luck, i.e. they are more open than most of us to encountering oddity or anomaly or an accident that potentially will trigger a different thought and that way lead us into a more successful framework. And I'm kind of just aware that we're getting towards the end of the show. Time always seems to go quickly. And there has been some noise behind me here, which is really my sound tiles falling off the wall because I'm in a sort of a chaotic studio at the moment. But it has led me to a question about when things change and change without expectation, how do we or should we cope with those changes in terms of, you know, do we see them as a challenge to be responded to quickly? So to Christian's point about it's a chance that we need to jump in and seize, or do you think we should hold back a little and take a more long-term view and not respond to the moment? What's your thoughts on that? Maybe Dev, if you wanted to tackle that one.
Yeah, I think it's kind of striking a balance between the two. Like we have a lot of tools at our disposal today, but it's about augmenting these tools with our imagination and possible technologies that fit in. And what you mentioned about when you respond to it, how do you respond to it? And today we are in this age of exponential technology growth, where to find this right fit for a solution, there have to be a lot of failed experiments in a way. And in essence, there's nothing wrong with that till we don't lose focus on finding the right fit and to perhaps even admitting that technology maybe cannot solve this problem. So I think it's more about striking a balance between responding and choosing to be more restrained, but also to kind of being very responsive in how you adapt to failures and feedback from whatever you're doing.
Yeah. And to add on what Dave was saying, we usually work with large corporations. And of course, you cannot do drastic shift at the scale of the entire large corporation right away. And so what we promote and what we like to work with is, let's say, innovation capsules, whether it's a certain series of a product line or it's a certain radical team in the broader innovation team. It's really about defining capsules that will be a bit more free from the constraints of large corporation and that can really embrace, let's say, the most radical changings that are coming up. The idea of, you know, shifting even research and development work from silo to being more contributive, open and networked. This is a huge shift for companies, and we believe that it can only happen through these very innovative capsules.
Okay, so that leads me then to my last question, which both of you can answer, one after the other, of course, is if somebody was to come to you tomorrow with the drop-dead brief that you go, wow, this is it, after this I can die, what do you think that brief should be, or what could it be?
I think that's an interesting one. I mean, I don't think I can sum it up into one brief, but I think the key challenge is to kind of back down from these ever-increasing profit and growth targets and to create targets of sustenance. I think brands, together with like economic and political systems, have to actively work towards figuring out this business model of sustenance, or what we sometimes call it as minimum viable production. And by this, I don't mean that we don't need growth. We absolutely do. But probably in areas of sustainable agriculture, renewable power generation, and regeneration in general. And all these have been proven to bring economic growth, but we still need to create the systems where this growth is enough to sustain human greed / need, in a way. Am I saying we need to overthrow capitalism and the free market? Maybe, but that's probably not the brief.
Well, you know what? Again, it's not, but if you think about degrowth as a brief, which is what you're describing, has a huge following at the moment. So I'm going to give you that. Adrian, did you have any final thoughts on that brief you would like to have?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as Dev said, this idea of aligning the very nature of a business with the constraints we are in is, I think, the big framework. But for us, what excites us the most within that framework and that thinking is about building the infrastructure for it. So what's the relevant infrastructure for this kind of regenerative and truly sustainable design? What's the infrastructure for manufacturing and for fabrication and for supply chains to solve what Dave was saying? I think for me, that's the super exciting, and it starts with really local experimentation and shifting from a corporate world that feels to me still very global and uniform to having more human-sized organizations and flows and value chain at really a local level, and to make it much more dynamic and contributive from a consumer standpoint.
Guys, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but I am fascinated by the fact that local traditionally would have meant getting rid of as much technology as possible. And I think your view of local is embracing the potential of future technologies in a way that makes it more human and makes it more nurturing and also makes it better and friendlier to the planet. Well, that's it for this week.
Thank you for having us, Martin.
Thank you, Martin.
A pleasure, chaps. This is Martin Raymond asking you all, of course, to keep looking, keep listening, and keep asking, as Dev and Adrian are asking, what's new and what's next?